Hello, welcome to the Gentle Rebel podcast. I'm Andy Mott, and this is a show about engaging with creative spirit, deep sensitivity, and playfulness to make more space for peace, meaning, and connection in a world that doesn't often give us chance to slow down and catch our breath. In this week's episode, I'm going to start the idea is to become a trio of episodes exploring the way I see the three main elements of creative spirit that we all navigate as humans. I define these under the brackets of sound, noise, and voice, which kind of gives us a structure that helps us firstly come home to our creative instincts, the intuition running within us, learn how to hold and process stuff going on around us, within us, in natural and sustainable ways, and then to express our sound in kind of conjunction with our relationship with the noise in the many ways that we currently engage with the world, and also to find pathways that are going to help us connect with new possibilities, new ways of expressing what it is that matters to us in the way that we are holding and processing the world into the future. So in this episode, I want to start with this idea of sound and its role in our creative spirit. We're going to think about the definition of our personal sound, you know, what it means to have a sound, where it sits within us, how it feels, where we locate it, and some of the ways that we potentially lose connection from it. Also, when I talk about creative spirit, I guess what I mean is that essence of aliveness that sits within each of us. Subjectivity, our experience of what it means and how it feels to be alive, how it feels to be us and to experience our lives in this world as a thinking, feeling, conscious being who can make choices that change the course of events. Our creative spirit is what we bring to every moment that invites us to gently change what would have happened without us into what could happen with us presently here. And in this sense, we're constantly invited into our creativity, into sensing the world, into processing experiences, into expressing ourselves with a spirit of possibility, depth, and openness to different potentials. This might sound like a kind of a big thing, but I honestly think it starts small. You know, it's simple. It's felt by all of us all of the time. It's the word of encouragement that we choose to share. The effort to be with someone when they need it, the eye contact with the person who everyone else is looking past and looking through. Creative spirit is both personal and collective. It's a response to our place in the collective, and it's a contributor to the potential of the collective. It reflects our experiences, our values, our beliefs, and it builds the reality that reinforces and transcends experiences, values, and beliefs. Creative spirit starts with a kernel of hope. Hope in the sense of awareness, acknowledgement, and understanding that we always have the ability to make a choice about how we think about, speak into, and act within any given moment. However small, however slow, it doesn't matter. Creative spirit runs on the faintest aromas and the tiniest cracks of light. So these three elements are the kind of core backbone as well of the materials that I've developed in my one-to-one fireside coaching program that's available through The Haven. We follow this trajectory of attuning to the sound of our creative core, noticing the noise that takes us away from ourselves and expressing our voice with confidence. I love supporting people along that journey, coming back to the things they naturally notice, naturally enjoy, naturally connect with, then letting go of stories, demands, and expectations that lead them away from their sound, and then picking up the pen, ready to write a new chapter in their story of becoming. And I think for highly sensitive people, especially, there are so many internalized beliefs, stories, defense strategies that keep us kind of hidden from ourselves. It's such a beautiful thing to see the dots reconnect and those parts of a person come back into communion, ready to move forwards with confidence in their creative spirit again. I say reconnect. Sometimes it's difficult to remember if it's ever happened before. Highly sensitive people might experience over-empathy, disconnection from their own preferences and desires, you know, people-pleasing, operating through a an I'm okay if you're okay lens, where we think, well, my safety depends on everybody else being okay, so I'll make sure everyone else's needs are met, and then I will be okay, essentially. These can become walls that stop us from befriending our deeply personal, creative, and joyful sensitivities. So how do we connect with our natural sound? Start with this idea of coming to your senses. You know, we might say someone has come to their senses when they employ sensible thinking after losing perspective, as far as we're concerned. You know, they see things in a right-minded way again. Ah, they've come to their senses, finally. I like to use the term in a slightly different way. In fact, I think it's quite fun to think about it in almost the opposite way, sort of turning it inside out. You know, we need more of us, I think, to genuinely come to our senses, to see, to feel, to taste, to smell, to hear things through the uniqueness of creative spirit, to confidently and courageously allow ourselves to experience and enjoy the depths of our sensory sensitivities, and then to build decisions, judgments, and values from the inside out, from that place, rather than conforming or seeking to conform to expectations, demands, and pressures that shut us off from those core natural organic ways of encountering the world. And so this phrase, come to your senses, is often used to signal that someone has returned to that state of so-called rational conformity. The senses that we come to, it's sensible compliance with how we ought to think, how we ought to act, how we ought to speak according to some set of often unwritten rules. Our sound is subtly dampened through the small and simple stories that we adopt and integrate over time from different social forces around our lives. And for example, our dreams can get shut down by people who are relieved that, oh, you came to your senses and you finally stopped pursuing that ridiculous thing. We imagine being able to write a book, but then, oh, we came to our senses and gave up on that silly idea. We imagine moving to a different country, but that was before we came to our senses and stayed put. Phrases like, oh, I'm glad you realized that, and oh, it's nice that you've got that out of your system, they can sound encouraging and supportive to some degree. And sometimes we do completely lose perspective and follow unhelpful paths, but that's not what I mean here. You know, we're talking about the kind of truthiness in how we perceive things, how we observe things, how we hold and notice things, where coming to our senses is seeing as we see rather than how we're supposed to see. You know, following what is compelling, following what is bringing us and our imaginations to life. And so for sensitive souls especially, we can lose our senses through over-empathy, through those things, people-pleasing, that I'm okay if you're okay filter. And I've met many people who tend to base their preferences and their opinions and tastes not on what they actually would truly choose if they allowed themselves. Often it doesn't occur to people that they can allow themselves to have a preference about something. But they make their preference based on what will keep other people happy or maintain a sense of peace in a social situation. And when this becomes a pattern, it's really hard to come to our senses. The filters become strong, and it's really difficult to reconnect with what it is that we truly want. It's really difficult to even allow ourselves to see the possibility that we have a preference. I noticed this once. I was out with a group of friends. We're trying to pick somewhere to eat for lunch. You've probably been in this situation before. Someone asks you, you know, where do you want to go? And I was like, oh, I don't mind, happy to go with whatever. If someone else has a preference, we'll go with that. And someone did have a preference, so we did go with that. And later on that day, I noticed I was feeling a bit sort of irritable, you know, just in a bad mood, I think. And after a bit of exploration, digging around, I figured out it had come from that decision. You know, maybe I did actually mind what we ate and I didn't want what we had. But even coming to that awareness, I think I'd have struggled to do anything different if that situation had been repeated right there and then, because there are all sorts of strong currents that make it hard for many sensitive people to make decisions that impact other people. But just because we can't start there, it doesn't mean we can't get there. And that's one of the things that we do in the Fireside Program, is sort of just exploring preferences and boundaries and ways to start to express what it is that we would want if we find ourselves in those positions where our preference is asked for. Do we just, conform to, okay, what's going to keep the peace here? What's going to enable me to just hide or drift into the background? And actually, do you know what? Maybe there is something that is important to you. How do you voice that in a way that feels good and doesn't feel exhausting? Because I think that's another one of these things that we often encounter in things around sort of boundaries and assertiveness, asserting ourselves is, for highly sensitive people, a lot of the techniques that come through that can be a bit jarring and can be kind of tiring. but there are ways to communicate preferences, to communicate things that are important to us that actually feel good to the nervous system as well, rather than something that just absolutely takes you out for the rest of the day, if not the week. One of the things videos that I share in the program as well is one with Kurt Vonnegut. Talks about his uncle Alex, who had a saying, "If this isn't nice, I don't know what is." And he says what Uncle Alex found objectionable about so many human beings is they would seldom notice when they were happy. And I find this it's a really interesting idea to reflect on. You know, happiness. What is happiness? Is it this thing that this ultimate thing we're wanting? Actually, and to a great degree, it is. You know, we all want to be happy. We're not saying no to happiness, but it's so much simpler than what we often make it out to be. It's really, by definition, very momentary and fleeting. It's an encounter with something that catches the sleeve of our attention in a moment. It's a present awareness of a sense of okayness, a sense of contentment in this moment. It's the acknowledgement of that contentment. It's neither caught in rumination on the past or worry about the future, but it's a mindful acknowledgement of something nice right here in front of us, right here in our hands, in our ears, in our whatever it is. And that's what it means to come to our senses. We can't sense in any other time except for right now in the present. We can't hold on to the thing, the object of our senses, any longer than it is present here in our ears, on our taste buds, in our hands. If this isn't nice, I don't know what is. Do you pause to acknowledge those things, to say that in a proverbial sense or maybe in a literal sense? Well, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. We encounter our sound when we allow ourselves to sense, without force and without second thoughts, to notice what stirs our soul and speaks to the nudge of happiness with how things are right now in this present moment. It's possible to find glimmers in the most surprising places. Deb Dana, who speaks about glimmers, describes them as micro moments when we feel a spark of connecting energy. It might provide a glimpse of safety, of warmth, of connection within, around, between us. They give us a feeling of home in our nervous system, telling us that the world around us is okay and we are okay within it. Deb Dana says that glimmers are all around us, but from a state of protection, they're very hard to find. Again, for many sensitive souls, we might have developed deep, protective, defensive patterns that prime us to sense the world through a protective lens, and we're less likely to notice nice things around us, notice those glimmers when they're there, when there is stress, when there is busyness, when there's numbness in our system. We become less attuned to the points of connection that fill our environments, fill our experiences. If we're receptive to noticing them, we will. So it takes deliberate practice to notice glimmers, to allow ourselves to find them in situations that we might think of as irritating, imperfect, annoying, not ideal. glimmers exist in those things too, in bad weather, in messed up plans, in failed efforts. There are still glimmers lurking between the lines around how things appear to be. What do we see beneath the surface, in the depths of the forest, beyond the obvious? And what do we sense within the details that everyone else seems to overlook? The things that seem so simple, so present, so clear. What do we notice that no one else seems to? These are clues, signals, pointers towards our sound. In his book, Several Short Sentences About Writing, Verlin Klinkenborg writes, "Is it possible to practice noticing? I think so. But I also think it requires a suspension of yearning and a pause in the desire to be pouring something out of yourself. Noticing is about letting yourself out into the world rather than siphoning the world into you. Noticing means thinking with all your senses. So what is noticing? A pinpoint of awareness, the detail that stands out amid all the details. It's catching your sleeve on the thorn of the thing you notice." I love that phrase. I use it a lot. I think I've already used it in this episode, actually, that idea of catching your sleeve on the thorn of the thing you notice. I find that it's so evocative. It has a real visceral quality to me. It's how it feels when some small detail won't let you go. Like a thorn, you know, you walk past a thorn and catch your sleeve on it. It takes a moment. You have to stop. You may have to reverse a little bit and unhook it gently. But I get it with all sorts of things, you know, music, stories, movies, TV shows, these things that just, they catch me. They bring me into a state of passion, a state of fascination, maybe even obsession. It's probably a similar process to the one that gives rise to rumination and overthinking, you know, where we fixate or we worry about things that are beyond our control or things that happened in the past. And, you know, I said something so stupid. I can't believe it. You know, when we ruminate on those things, we, our imagination sort of consumes us with these worries, with these regrets and stuff like that. But rather than letting the imagination lavish its energy on making up stories that cause misery for ourselves, this kind of opens up a flow of creative possibility, of allowing things to catch our attention and to move towards them, to play with them, to smush them together, to morph them, to see what might come out the other side as we do so. It's the difference, I suppose, between obsessive and harmonious passion. Harmony being the resonance of frequencies, a tonal togetherness where imagination, thoughts, actions all come together and play a chord that works, that sounds good, that feels good. And our sound is the spirit of exploration. It doesn't draw or declare its conclusions. It simply observes. It notices and is interested in the noticing. I suppose that's the difference, maybe, with what happens in obsessive rumination, where rumination is a loop. It's kind of closed and conclusive. Or at least it's conclusive in the sense of what it wants to find, where it's looking and where it will end up, you know, back where it started in this feedback loop that just gathers more and more noise. It moves into a preconceived story about ourselves, the thing it wants to reinforce, the message of the story that, you know, it's going to notice these things to support this message that is essentially probably going to be damning of ourselves. And it closes itself off to alternative hypotheses because it's already decided what is true and everything is gathered to reinforce that decision, that story. I've just finished a short video looking at how we make decisions. And I think I'm going to actually just drop a clip from that now in this episode because it speaks to this difference between kind of intelligence gathering mode, observation mode, and evidence gathering mode. So crime documentaries often highlight poor investigative work that's done by law enforcement who you know, make up their mind about what happened and who committed the crime before they actually do any intelligence gathering. There are some cases where key evidence is overlooked because it doesn't fit the narrative that the investigator has settled on from the outset. That's why it often seems absurd, doesn't it, when you get to sort of watch a case being revealed through a documentary in a very formulaic way. You know, how can they not see this key piece of evidence that's pointing elsewhere? Well, because they're not looking for it. And why aren't they looking? Because it's unnecessary evidence when it comes to supporting the story that they've already decided is true before they've finished gathering the intelligence, or before they've started gathering the intelligence a lot of the time. While it is sometimes a deliberate effort to cover up the truth or conceal a conspiracy, most of the time this is just a symptom of something very human, something that we all do, taking shortcuts, making assumptions, shutting off our senses to other possibilities and avenues of inquiry. It's always the partner. Shortcuts might be statistically true and probably play out in anecdotal evidence over a long career, but just because something is more likely, it doesn't make it true right now. The TV show American Nightmare, which recounts the horrific ordeal of Denise Huskins, who in 2015 was kidnapped and taken in the middle of the night by an intruder, demonstrates this perfectly. Her boyfriend Aaron was questioned by the police, who, rather than taking him at his word as part of the intelligence gathering process that could then lead to Denise's whereabouts potentially and save her from the brutality of the abuse that she suffered in the meantime, chose to interrogate him to draw out a confession for her murder, with absolutely nothing to support that hypothesis. When Denise later reappeared, the narrative quickly changed to accusations that, oh, she's faked this kidnapping in the recreation of the plot of the movie Gone Girl. Again, rather than believing what she had to say, the police had already decided the truth and went about trying to force the evidence to fit it and ignore anything that didn't. So during intelligence mode, we might ask, what do I want to find out here? What don't I know yet? Who could I talk to? What would I want to ask them? Where can I go to learn more? How will I know when I've got the information that I need? What is going to help me understand this situation better? In other words, the possibilities aren't endless. The gathering has a purpose, but there are no conclusions to be drawn yet. A hunch or a hypothesis will begin to form as you investigate and eventually come to a decision about the best way forward from where you are with what you have. So while our sound is distinctly personal, it's also experienced within the collective context. And I suppose, like Denise Huskins' ordeal, when we jump to conclusions, what we think we notice can have an adverse impact on the lives of other people. And we will get into that in more detail when we talk about noise in the second part of this trio of episodes. This is about the way interference can really get in the way. We end up filtering things through unhelpful stories, lenses, soundtracks, past experiences, those kinds of things. But yeah, at a basic level, not everyone notices the same things as us. Our sound is unique. You know, many people walk past the same bush without being caught by the thorn. They have their own thorns that catch them. And yet it can be hard to believe that other people haven't noticed what seems so obvious, so loud, so present. It can sometimes be frustrating, especially if we notice a really pressing issue that actually we all need to attend to very urgently. When it becomes desirable to communicate with others and encourage them to notice what we're noticing. And again, this is a huge thing for highly sensitive people. You know, maybe you can think of a time or times when you were picking up on signals that something isn't quite right here, something isn't okay. We need to address this, or somebody else needs to address this. The people that actually have kind of influence in this situation need to listen to what's going on and do something proactive, but they just can't see it. And I think this is definitely part of our sound. You know, some people will notice stuff well ahead of the curve. And again, we'll get into that, you know, what we do with that when we get into the noise, and especially when we get into kind of voice as well, because that antagonism, there's like an internal conflict there for a lot of highly sensitive people who maybe notice things that need noticing by the wider community, but speaking up about it is really uncomfortable and sometimes even dangerous. when it goes against the prevailing sort of social norms and the cultural expectations, the way that the status quo, I suppose. And so this can be a huge source of anxiety, especially if you have this antagonism between, you know, I see this as it is. I can see there's an issue here, but I really don't want to rock the boat. I want to maintain a sense of social peaceableness in order for my own nervous system to feel safe, to feel okay. And I guess another thing to say in relation to the analogy of kind of catching our sleeve on the thorn of the things we notice is it's not always a pleasant feeling to get caught like that. It can snag, it can tear things. You know, you catch your sleeve. If you keep running away from that thorn, it's probably going to tear through your sleeve, or it may catch your skin. But this is something worth listening to. You know, what is it telling us about how and what we see, how and what we feel, taste, smell, hear around our lives? Maybe our sleeve is a metaphorical kind of emotional response. It might be an unexpected tear that you're like, oh, wow, that has caught me there. Or something that we wake up thinking about in the night. Our attention is hooked on a detail that stands out amid all the details. Our creative spirit precedes reasons and left brain thinking. It begins with giving ourselves the space and permission for noticing, and to notice what we notice, not to bottle and imprison it with cognitive meaning making and overthinking and analysis and, oh, I wonder why I'm thinking that. I wonder why I've noticed that. That can just derail the whole beautiful process of inspiration. But instead, it's to simply be aware that we are noticing, and to turn toward the thing we're noticing and to explore it, to allow our attention to be caught by an awareness beneath and beyond the part of our brain that explains. Again, this helps guide our attention away from rumination and toward creative playfulness. Creative spirit transcends language. It loves to squidge, to squeeze, to squash, to play with the world it encounters. It notices what it notices because it notices. Something caught our attention. It made a funny noise. It tastes a bit peculiar. It looks enticing. Now is not the time to ask why. It's an opportunity to enjoy it. Notice what you've noticed and let that be an invitation to play. I think this is where we find the headwaters of creative spirit, the trickle at the source of the river of creativity that we want to feel flowing through our lives. So what causes a loss of connection? I think that there are a few things. We've talked a little bit about some of those already, but I think another part is that we wonder if we're allowed to like what we like. You know, there's communal groupthink, mimetic desire that can inform this, where we outsource our tastes to the taste makers and trendsetters that give us the rules for fitting in. We lose connection with our sound when we run everything we notice through a filter or through a set of standards that we haven't decided for ourselves, we haven't consciously really thought about, we haven't intentionally adopted and accepted. The disconnection occurs between the stimulus and our response. A space where we have the power to choose how we're going to act, a hugely helpful thing when it comes to, you know, stepping beyond emotional reactiveness and acting out of unthought through passion. But it is also where we question our intuition and our instincts and our nudges. Second thoughts take over in that space between stimulus and response, where we think, actually, maybe it's not best for me to like or to think or to enjoy or to move towards that. People will think I'm a bit weird. Creative spirit is the core of our weirdness, our ordinary weirdness. You know, we have second thoughts that convince us that our initial feelings weren't right. We don't acknowledge or allow the tastes, the preferences, the attention-catching thorns to speak. This can happen in moments, but it can also happen over a long period of time where we lose connection from this part of us that we might not even remember ever being connected with in the first place. And when this is the case, it might take us to reconnect with the wonder and the mystery of childlike energy, the way we noticed, held, gazed the world around us before we took on the weight of responsibility for the well-being of the world itself, allowing that to dictate our preferences and observations. It can be a subtle slide towards and into that, which many highly sensitive people have experienced if they've been in situations, environments with a lack of well-regulated nervous systems. So if you're up for it, here's the challenge I want to leave you with this week. A glimmer record. Record the things you notice. Write them down. Take photos. Speak them into your phone's voice memo app. Whatever is simplest and easiest for you. And when you do, don't judge. Don't think about it. Just go, huh, that caught my attention. Make a note. Don't analyze why. You don't need to know why you notice something. Just notice it. Just allow it. No one else needs to know what it is that you're recording either. So don't worry about like, oh, what are other people going to think about these things that I've been drawn towards, the things that I've noticed. And notice any resistance that you have in letting yourself notice, in letting yourself record. Again, don't do that by analyzing it, but just witness the resistance. Collect it as part of that data bank. And then in the next part, we're going to look at the role of noise in this creative spirit trio. And so that resistance is part of the noise. But noise isn't always something to turn down or to eradicate. If we understand and reframe our relationship with it, our creative spirit can use the noise to open up some really interesting pathways to explore, to help us find our creative voice as we express our sound through our lives. If you have any questions, anything you'd like to add, anything that's particularly resonated with you, please do get in touch. You can drop me a message through the contact form on my website, andymort.com/contact, or in the comments below the show notes at andymort.com, or anywhere on social media, basically. So yeah, it'd be great to hear from you. Have a lovely week, and I will be back again soon with another episode of the Gentle Rebel podcast. Until then, do remember that you are an artist. The world needs your art. Now go and make somebody's day. Bye-bye.